This is Charlottesville Tomorrow. Charlottesville Tomorrow is a nonprofit organization engaging the public on critical quality of life issues so we make informed choices for our community's future. Visit us on the web at sevilletomorrow.org.
On September 27, 2017, the six candidates for the Charlottesville City Council took questions on traffic, affordable housing, and how the city should respond to increased growth in Albemarle County's southern growth area.
Well, good evening.
The candidate forum was sponsored by the Fry Spring and Johnson Village Neighborhood Associations. The moderator is Brian Becker, president of the Fry Spring Neighborhood Association.
What we're going to do this evening is we have our six candidates. We're going to give each of them a opening statement. Then we have six questions that we developed that we're going to give each a turn, answering the questions in turn. That'll put us about an hour and a half, for approximately, maybe 90 minutes in. And then we'd like to open up the questions to the floor. But to make sure that every candidate gets a question, we request that you write them down on these note cards, and then I will make sure that everyone gets a question. Heather Walker has the questions up, the cards up there. If something comes up during the forum, please sneak over there and grab a card, and she'll pass those on to me. And we expect to be wrapped up. We'll have a closing statement, and then we'll be done about 8 o'clock. Heather will provide each of you a 15, 20-second caution, and then the red card when our time is up.
It'll be 15 seconds.
Okay. So I want to thank each of the candidates for your willingness to serve Charlottesville, especially at this time. Obviously, there's a lot of profound and emotional issues that we're addressing, but there's also some very mundane issues running the city on a daily basis. And so we try to get a little bit above that with these questions, at least for get the conversation started. So with that, I'd like to turn it over to Mr. Hall. You have 2 minutes for your opening statement. Thank you.
Thank you, Brian. The City Council is the main decision-making body in the city of Charlottesville. It is responsible for adopting ordinances and plans dealing with historic preservation, design guidelines for buildings, creating and amending design control districts, designating individually protected properties, deciding appeals of the Board of Architectural Review, appointing members of the Board of Architectural Review, and other boards, commissions, task forces, and committees. An example is the Planning Commission, i.e., a 7-member board appointed by the City Council. The Board of Architectural Review was created by the City Council in May 1991. This provides the listener with the scope of what the City Council does that benefits the city. Unfortunately, the City Council of Charlottesville has gotten off track from its regular duties. Now, examples of this include the votes taken to remove the Civil War statues from Emancipation and Justice Parks. Such votes taken went against the will of the people and ran counter to normal council business. Becoming a city council person is also a heady responsibility and not to be taken lightly. Join me in my quest to right these wrongs. Write me a letter. My address is 2427 Sunset Road in Charlottesville, 22903, or send me an email, john.hall57@gmail.com. Let me know how you are doing. Thank you.
Thank you.
Good evening, and thank you to the Fry Springs and Johnson Village Neighborhood Associations for putting together tonight's forum, and all of you for being here. A little about me. My husband, John, and I have 3 children, a 7-year-old who's a second grader at Burnley Moran, a 5.5-year-old, and a 2-year-old. I engage with the city through my role as a neighborhood leader in the North Downtown Residents Association and as a member of the Belmont Bridge Steering Committee. My background is industrial and systems engineering, and I have a master's in business. I really need to think about the acts of terror, though, that have taken place in our city in recent months that have left our community hurting and all of us seeking answers. Transparency and accountability in how our city is managed has always been a top priority of mine and could not be more important now. A lot of people, including me, are disappointed in the way leadership has handled recent events. More than ever, we need strong leaders who are committed to taking responsibility, finding the answers we so desperately seek, and working with our community to solve the city's most complex issues. I am that kind of leader. In February, when I launched my campaign, I committed to listening. Since that time, I've walked every street in our city, every door knocked by my campaign before the primary was done by me, to hear firsthand the concerns and priorities among those I hope to serve. The hours I've personally spent sitting in living rooms and on porches, listening to stories, has inspired and energized me. The priority I heard most among the neighborhoods hosting us this evening has been infrastructure and multimodal transportation, followed by affordable housing and development and planning. Not surprisingly, this aligns with the topic areas that will be posed to us this evening. To address any of our top priorities, it's going to require leadership with empathy that will listen to all voices. It's going to take partnerships among citizens and community leaders and action-oriented problem solving. I look forward to the conversation this evening, including ideas among my fellow candidates for how these may be addressed. Our city's challenges will require a collaborative effort. Thank you.
My name is Kenneth Jackson. I'm a 50-year-old born, raised, and educated native of Charlottesville. I also have a 29-year-old, or soon-to-be 29-year-old daughter who was born, raised, and educated right here in Charlottesville. Actually, I went to school right here at Johnson School from 4th to 5th grade, or kind of halfway through 5th, then I had to go to Clark. But I have known this city, and I've been in every neighborhood of this city my entire life. The reason I decided to run for city council is because this is not our city. This is not the way we do things. I've heard people say that we've had problems and this has all been festering and stuff. This isn't Charlottesville, and this is not what Charlottesville needs to be known for. The 12th or any other time. I hear a lot of people yelling and pointing things at one issue, the statute made me do it and all that stuff, and we're forgetting the real issues that concern Charlottesville. Affordable housing, real jobs, fixing up our public housing and making it a stepping stone and not a crutch. I look at people as people. Maybe that's something strange about me at my age and given my experiences in life, from foster care to anything else that I've experienced. But I don't ever want someone to look at me as a black man. I want you to look at me as a human being. And I think we all need to look at each other as human beings. And I think your city leaders, like I said, government is of, for, and by the people. And your local city leaders are the main government that you can actually reach out and touch and be in touch with. My phone number is listed. My address is there. I don't mind people calling me. Even if I get on council, I still expect you to call me, even if it's just to say hi or chit-chat. Come by for tea. If I can't be there for you as a leader, I don't need to be there for you at all.
Thank you. I also want to say thank you to Johnson Village Neighborhood Association and Heather and the Fry Springs Neighborhood Association and Brian for organizing this, and Seville Tomorrow for the mics and everything, because it's much easier to communicate when people can hear you. Actually, Heather and I spoke with some of you during the primary. We came to the Fry Springs Neighborhood Association, had a great time talking with you all. And some of you may not know, but I actually used to live in Willoughby Subdivision when my husband and I first got married. And then my son, actually my middle son, attended Jackson Baya through his elementary school years. So I'm really happy to be here. I've been on the school year board for about 6 years. And before that, I was on the Commission for Children and Families for about 4 years. So I've been in the community working on behalf of our citizens. And, you know, what we saw this summer was really traumatizing. You know, seeing these familiar places, places that we frequent often, become scenes of terror, tanks, guns, and even death is really traumatic for all of us. And then on top of that, to have our community leaders that we don't understand exactly what their role was or accounting for what they were doing before, during, and after can add to that trauma. And it's really important that we remember, you know, these crazy groups that came in, they're gone, but we're here and we're left to deal with the issues that we all face with affordable housing, workforce development, job creation. And it's really important that we have leaders that are purposeful and serious in this issue. And I'd like to put myself forward as a person like that. I have been on school board, dealt with budgets and policies, and I'd like to work on your behalf as city council. And I look forward to talking with you tonight more about issues of Charlottesville. Thank you.
My name is Paul Long, and I'm running. And I want to thank the two neighborhood associations for inviting me to participate in the candidate forum tonight. I'm running for city council because I think the last 2 years, the leadership on city council has been a disgrace. We had a mayor who took over, Mike Singer, who arbitrarily took upon himself power and authority that was not delegated to him, and the city council allowed him to get away with it. He designated this city as a capital of the resistance, which I have no problem with, but he didn't put it up to a vote before city council. He arbitrarily made that decision. Last April, I led a demonstration, and I called him a neo-fascist, and I got some flack. But that particular activity that he did was a fascist activity where he assumed power that was not his lawfully to take upon himself. He has a PhD and a law degree, and there's no reason for him not to know exactly how the city government of this city works. I think that the activities that happened with the Ku Klux Klan rally on April 12th is a disgrace. It was a complete breakdown of leadership on the part of city council. All five members of the city council told everybody how sorry they were, and I think that's a good expression, good term to describe the current city council as a very sorry group of people. You know, I think Mayor Singer, and I'm researching how to get him removed from office. I don't think he should continue in office. He's a disgrace. 2 years ago, when Kathy Gavin, Mike Singer, and Russ Bellamy ran for city council, they raised $77,000 for their joint campaign. A lot of it came from the Virginia Realtors Association, Mark Brown, and other business people. I asked them to explain how they got the money, how they were spending it. Never got a response, you know. And I think that the Mike Singer and the entire council are captives to corporate America. And one example of that is them giving the Landmark Hotel $1 million tax break. That's a disgrace. Thank you.
Thank you to the Fry Springs Neighborhood Association and the Johnson Village. Appreciate the invite. As I was walking up the steps here, I started the lyrics to "Oh Hell to James G. Johnson School," because I used to sing that as an elementary school student here. I currently have a niece that is a student, and you know, tons of other family and friends. So very familiar with Charlottesville. I have, as you know, been. Since March, since I announced my campaign, talking about things that are not very popular, even though they're getting, you know, a lot of attention after the events of the summer. And I would just like to make sure that we are aware that that's, you know, just typically how I work. Long before things are popular, long before people want to discuss things openly, I am the person and have been all of my life who will bring those topics to the forefront, even though it usually puts me in a position where, you know, I'm labeled as angry, disgruntled, hostile. And I think after the events of the summer that we finally saw that we had a lot that we needed to discuss, a lot that was right at the surface of things in Charlottesville. And we hear a lot of times that, you know, people kind of, you know, rode into town and rode out, but that's not the case. There are a lot of people in Charlottesville that have participated and upheld the structures that are in place that are causing our city the great difficulties that we are experiencing. And unless you're in the rooms of some of those places, you can miss it. So as we go on through the night and for the rest of the campaign season until November, just remember that I am the person that will bring topics up long before they're popular. Thank you.
Thank you very much. So we touched on a lot of things, and there'll be some of these bigger issues that we'll be coming back to, as I said. neighborhoods, we have some mundane concerns as well. And one that is a perennial topic at many of our neighborhood association meetings is traffic. So we'll just start with the little things and work our way up. So the question is, and I'll start with Mr. Hall, and each of you will have an opportunity to address, how would you address and expedite the neighborhood traffic concerns?
Neighborhood traffic concerns such as speeding, not yielding the right-of-way to pedestrians at the crosswalks, or other breaking of law such as not coming to a complete not coming to a complete stop at a stop sign can be brought before the city, and we can strengthen our laws so that we can work to hasten or facilitate the passing of new ordinances or rules so that lack of observation of the ordinances or rules will mean a high dollar fine or jail time. Seriously, neighborhood traffic concerns are on the minds of all the people of Charlottesville since the events of August 12th, when James Alex Field Jr. of Maumee, Ohio was charged with second-degree murder in the death of Heather Heyer, paralegal in Charlottesville. There were three counts of malicious wounding and one count of hit and run resulting in death. Fields ignored the stop sign at 4th and Water Street, and his actions resulted in the loss of Heather and injuring of 35 others. I think that these kind of crime needs to be addressed. We need to send a signal that we don't want this kind of thing ever again to occur in our town. That's all I have to say. Thank you.
The question was around ideas and how to address and expedite neighborhood traffic concerns. And during my time as a neighborhood leader the last 5 years, traffic concerns and the impact that development has on our street infrastructure and the safety of our streets has consistently been a top priority of neighborhoods throughout our community. I met in person with one of the outgoing traffic engineers 2 years ago because I was getting increasingly frustrated with some of the lack of responsiveness in my neighborhood. My goal was to try to better understand the barriers that were in place, and I was doing that as an engaged citizen. And I really was interested in working with staff to determine ways to overcome these hurdles so that we could have some progress throughout the city. What I uncovered were systemic issues, including there are gaps and inconsistencies in the way these concerns are reported, tracked, and communicated, a lack of clear process for determining prioritization and getting resources assigned. Based on what I took away from these experiences, it is clear that once again we need more transparency and accountability for concerns our community is bringing forward, instead of the perception or reality that everything is going into a black box. This can be aided, and this also is very dry, but by technologies that will enable appropriate tracking of issues visible to both staff and citizens, independent of any staff member, as turnover is a problem. We need to educate citizens as well on the general guidelines for feasible options to deal with traffic calming, because oftentimes we come with answers or solutions that we think will be in place, and then we're told that the rules and regulations, whether it's the state or locality, are getting in the way of us pursuing those options. So I think we need to educate our community. We also need to implement processes for how these concerns are reported and prioritized. I think neighborhoods find themselves escalating through multiple routes beyond just staff because they're not getting answers to it. And by taking it to city council, sometimes that can create more churn on our staff and even less responsiveness. And we really do need appropriate staffing, I think, both in terms of the number of staff that we have and the qualification of that staff. And we really need to evaluate how they're going to be compensated, because turnover has been a notable issue with three traffic engineers over the last few years. Our current engineer has walked into a tremendous backlog of concerns while also balancing a lot of site plan reviews. And ultimately, what all of us should be striving for is working together for an efficient partnership among our city council, our citizens, and our staff.
Being born and raised here, I've watched our city streets become more like just highways. I mean, I can sit here and tell you all kinds of good things that sound wonderful. The fact of the matter is, our city council, not just this one, but all previous ones, have threw up traffic calming things that don't work. Even national statistics say they don't work. We need to get serious about it. First of all,
come into the neighborhoods. We as counselors must come into the neighborhoods to see exactly what's going on. We have to enforce it by tickets, not by putting people in jail, unless you want your tax dollars to get your pockets to get hit even more, because incarcerating people costs money. But we have to get serious about traffic and not just lip service. Actually get out there and start doing something. I mean, look at the other side of Cherry Avenue. It's just like 64. It's like a parking lot half the time because you can only move so far. And this is looped around because the city's planning is poor. It's like paved paradise and put up a parking lot. And where do you think these cars are going to go? They're going to come through our neighborhoods like they've been doing for decades. So the first thing to do is to sit down with each community and each neighborhood and find out where the traffic problems are and actually get serious about how to alleviate them. We put in so many bypasses and so many roundabouts and all this stuff, and the traffic is still horrible because rather than go out of their way, they'll cut through our neighborhoods. So that's what I have to say about traffic. I understand.
Thank you.
So I, too, walked many neighborhoods, talked about many issues, and traffic was consistent throughout the city. And we can see all of the development that's going on, not just in the city, but outside of the city. And it does cause congestion, absolutely. And I think I would say probably Brian or many of the other neighborhood association leaders have actually talked with Brennan Duncan, who is our traffic engineer. I actually, raise your hand if you've talked to him. I'm sure many of you have. Right. You know, he only has one other employee. He's dealing with Belmont Bridge, the 250 footpath over in my neighborhood off to Derry Road, and all the other. I mean, if you drive through the city, you see all of the development that's going on and all the construction we're doing. You know, I think I'd be interested in seeing possibly another employee that could be hired, and definitely creating a clear process. You know, when the complaints come in or the concerns come in, that they're logged in a specific way and we're coming back to the people that have brought them to us with an idea. And something we did with the school board, we got together all the PTO chairs 4 times a year to go over not just their school's issues but what's happening in the school division. And I would be really interested in seeing if we could put together the neighborhood association leaders into having some type of way to communicate together with our traffic engineer and other staff members. And the other thing I think we really need to do and neighborhood associations could do is reach out to the county neighborhood associations. Many of our communities are sharing the same issues, and if we can have all of these groups working together to come up with solutions, I think we can work on creating better solutions for all of our city. Thank you.
I've been living in Charlottesville since February of 1998. That's almost 20 years. And prior to coming to Charlottesville, I was born and raised in Philadelphia. And for 20 years, I lived in an immediate suburb of Philadelphia called Tenekin Township. And I was appointed by that township by their Board of Supervisors, which is an all-Republican body, to be their representative to the Southeastern Pennsylvania Transportation Authority, because I had fought for their proposal to reduce public transit service to that township. And I filled that post for 13 years. Traffic has gotten 10 times worse in the 20 years that I've been here. The development that's going on in Elmore County and Charlottesville and the surrounding counties, Charlottesville needs a public transit authority. You know, there's too many cars. We can keep on building new highways and expand to 2 lanes to 6 lanes, and as soon as you build that, that doesn't solve the problem. I've heard it expressed that the only people who use public transit are people that are too poor to buy a car. That attitude's got to change. And I'm proposing that we have buses that run every 20 minutes, that the transit service be extended extensively into Elmore County and hopefully the surrounding counties. When I worked at UVA Medical Center for 17 years, this is just anecdotal, but I asked a lot of employees who lived in the surrounding counties, if there was a bus that you could take into work and get to home, would you use it? And a lot of them said yes. That has to be a number one priority. Charlottesville is no longer a sleepy college town. It's developing into a city. And the part of the problems of a major urban area is traffic congestion. If we can get one-third of the people who use cars to at times use public transit to get to work and to come downtown and do some of their business, that would greatly reduce the amount of traffic in this city and the area.
So within the past year or so at city council meetings, we had citizens who felt like their concerns about traffic was being ignored come to council meetings and actually bring evidence of speeding, not obeying the speed limit to council's attention. And I think that would be, you know, one of the first steps is making sure that the city council that we've elected, that they are discussing citizens' concerns openly and in a way that citizens don't feel ignored. We also, in these same meetings, I heard concerns about traffic, the traffic lights not being matched up so that traffic can flow better. So those are some of the concerns we could look at. And of course, the pedestrian, you know, friendly and bike friendly. And I have had experiences with public transportation and it not being very friendly to individuals who are trying to use that as a mode of transportation. So it's definitely something, you know, that we can improve. A few years back, I attempted to use the trolley in the morning, so around 8 a.m. to get my son to Venable from where we live in the Belmont area, and it didn't work, and we often walked. So it's very important that we have systems in place where those things like public transportation can take the load off of roads where more people can use them. Thank you.
All right, thank you. So our next question actually was about transportation, and quite a few of you went into that, so I'll offer you the opportunity also to maybe address how to address the neighborhood traffic concerns at the same time as we go back. So we'll start with Ms. Hill. The question is about transportation in the neighborhood around the city and the region. So please address that, and or if you already did, some of our traffic, the neighborhood traffic concerns directly.
So my time walking every street certainly raised my awareness of the deficits that we have in our infrastructure relative to transportation systems, not only vehicles, but for bikes and pedestrians, as has been talked about. I believe if we make a smart investment in these systems, they will be utilized more broadly. You know, if you build it, they will come. But we can't look at transportation systems solely within the boundaries of our city. We need to consider how we travel throughout our region, especially when we think about how many people come into our city from outside of its boundaries for work every day. I was blown away by the lack of sidewalk infrastructure throughout our neighborhoods. This must be a priority for safety, for quality of life, and for the health of all of our community. We need to double our investment. Right now, there's $200,000 that allocated in the CIP funds for new sidewalks. Then that's certainly not enough, and we should be doing more. Additionally, we need to evaluate opportunities for connections through greenway trails so that we can have greater connectivity throughout the region. I spent a morning with a resident here in this neighborhood who asked me to ride the cat with her, and it was 30 minutes late. When public transportation is unreliable for those who need it, we must dig deeper. CAT is collecting data that we really should be using as part of our open data portal in order to provide a layer of accountability so we can use them both as residents and neighborhood leaders to understand the critical public service and how we can be more informed advocates for how we can make it better. We also have to look at efficient alternatives for commuters that are coming in, whether it's from the West in Crozet or the East in Zion Crossroad. We need to be finding efficient ways to bring them in more mass without having individuals coming in with one person in each car. I rode my bike constantly when I lived in Minneapolis, Minnesota, when it wasn't like below zero. But I found that when I came back to Charlottesville, that I really had a hard time feeling like it was safe to traverse in that way. So I think that we really need to be looking hard at investing in that infrastructure as well, because I think if that was available to people in safe alternative ways, that they would be using it. These investments can't be done for our city alone, however. It's going to take partnerships with our county and perhaps counties beyond ours. Last week, the Board of Supervisors and Council voted to support a regional transit partnership, and Paul was mentioning this earlier. It's a step towards a regional transit authority. But it's one thing to have things on paper. We really need to act, and both human and financial resources need to be allocated to take care of that.
Thank you.
Well, transportation has always been a problem. Anyone who's lived here long enough knows that CTS has always been late. So that's something that should have been looked at, something that should have been dealt with. Why are they late? what are our problems, what are our holdups. One thing you'll find that a lot of our problems is traffic, not just in Charlottesville, but Albemarle. So, yes, we do have to start working with the county. We have to build a relationship back with the county. We also have to look at regions like Buckingham. A lot of people from Buckingham come into Charlottesville. There's also a lot of people from Charlottesville who go other places to work. I met a lady who lives here, and she goes to Harrisonburg to work. So we have to look at getting with Augusta County, all these regions, and working out a regional transit. But we also have to be mindful of cost, because the one thing that we all want, we want everything wonderful, but realistically, and most of you who own houses and stuff know, it's going to hit your pocket. And everything sounds great. I like bikes. I have nothing against bikes, nothing against mopeds. One of the biggest problems I found even today was there are rules of the road. They've been in the DMV books forever. And bicyclists, mopeds, everyone needs to learn how to use it. But we have to look at our traffic problems. How many cars are on our road? How many more do we expect on our road? How many vehicles? What's going to be the best route for transit? Because one thing when you consider transit is the routes, because transit buses burn gas, they burn diesel, they burn whatever they need to. But we have to be smart about transit. We've got to be realistic about it, and we've got to actually start acting and not talking, as Ms. Hill said.
Well, actually, I want to go over the question again. I'm sorry.
So the first question was about neighborhood concerns about traffic, and the second one is, I apologize, rather similar, about transportation.
Right. It's a little different. I mean, traffic, transportation is kind of combined, of course, but transportation, we'd be talking more about all modes of transportation, walking, biking, buses. And I think our buses need to get more streamlined and more convenient and consistent. I know the school division really struggled with that the past couple of years, and we finally taken over a new system, helping us figure out new bus routes, lessening how many times they stop. We've saved like $80,000 in gas just by making the bus stops closer all together. And I think we need to be looking at the routes to see if they're convenient for people and where really do people need to be going. And I'm certainly interested in increasing bike and pedestrian-friendly routes. We see many of our millennials especially really don't want to own a car, and we need to be serious about providing these kind of amenities to people. I mean, even my own husband bought a bike and started biking to work. I mean, that's a real statement. So, and other things, I think we need to combine with the county many more issues, especially in traffic. We know that the county actually tried to get money from VDOT to help with the Sunset Avenue area, and they weren't able to get the money because they didn't have enough support. And if we were to combine writing the grants with them, we could show that there's two municipalities looking at the same road. We could show many more people that are going to be affected by it, and we'd be more likely to get the these monies to improve our infrastructure. So I'm certainly interested in improving our system so that everybody can move throughout the city in more efficient and effective ways.
Thank you.
One of the things that amazed me about the Virginia form of government is that Thomas Jefferson supposedly developed a theory of democracy being the best democracy, letting the government closest to the people have authority to solve problems. And I had to research what the Dillon Law was. I think the city of Charlottesville needs a home rule charter, and so does Alamo County. They were not forbidden to do a variety of things. And Charlottesville doesn't have the ability to either tax or come up with funding for public transit unless it goes to the General Assembly and ask for permission, which under normal circumstances is not going to be given because of the Republican dominance. One of the things that I think can be done is a lot of the bus routes right now don't have a great ridership. We can use the smaller vehicles until the ridership is built up. I think we need a commitment to expand the transit authority. It's not going to happen overnight, and that means sometimes being aggressive and being in people's face. Our city should be in Richmond lobbying the General Assembly and the government for the authority to develop this regional transit authority and we can't get discussed it just because we do it once, 1 year, we don't get anywhere. We have to be, I think I accomplished a lot in Philadelphia for bus routes just by being persistent and being in people's faces, and a lot of times they agreed with me just to get me to shut up. You know, and that's Northern Philadelphia way of looking at it, but sometimes that approach is necessary. If I'm elected to city council, in terms of the public transit authority and other issues, I will be that pain in the neck.
Thank you.
Yeah, so I think I answered this the last question, but yes, improving our CAT system is, you know, very important, and making sure that it's run on time and that the routes work for the individuals that are using them. I know currently a family member who's attempting to get from the county just over in the, and I think that's one of our questions later, from the county to into the city to work from Eagles Landing. They have to take the shuttle from Eagles Landing and then get to bus transportation after UVA because that, it just doesn't exist. So that is one thing that we can work on, but also making sure that when you're talking about biking, walking, that, you know, it's sidewalk friendly. And I talked earlier about the, you know, traffic, the traffic lights, and making sure that they are run in a way that can make sure that the flow of traffic is going smoothly. Thanks.
Thank you. Mr. Hall.
The Metropolitan Planning Organization, MPO, part of the Thomas Jefferson Planning District Commission, the TJPDC, is the forum for cooperative transportation decision-making among Charlottesville, Albemarle, state and federal officials. The MPO considers long-range regional projects and combines public input, technical data, and agency collaboration to develop forward-thinking solutions. Organized for the city of Charlottesville and the urbanized area of Albemarle County immediately surrounding the city, the MPO is responsible for carrying out continuing cooperative and comprehensive transportation planning and programming. The MPO coordinates the transportation planning activities of the various transportation-related agencies that have both a direct and indirect impact on the long-range plan and transportation improvement program. Other options and choices for the TJPDC transportation include rideshare, i.e. free carpool and school pool matching, van pool coordination, and the guaranteed ride home program to provide free rides home in an emergency, and the rural transportation program, which functions as a cooperative forum for transportation planning among VDOT, the Virginia Department of Rail and Public Transportation, transportation services providers, and the counties of Fluvanna, Green, Louisa, Nelson, and Albemarle. Just to conclude, I'd like to say that I've thought from the first that I'd like to see a change machine be put in the downtown transit station so that people don't lose their quarters or they're getting change from riding the bus. Usually it's a 75% fee, 75-cent fee, and they only get a, they miss getting a quarter back. Thank you.
Thank you. So moving on to a slightly different topic, though somewhat related. Mr. Walker, sorry, Ms. Jackson, we'll start with you. Can you share your thoughts on what affordable housing means to you and your ideas for providing it?
Well, there are two facets when you say affordable housing. There's low-income housing, which has to be affordable because those people don't make that much money. But it also has to be, to me, a step to move people up and out. We have to get serious as a city government and work with agencies, nonprofits, religious organizations to help make this happen. And when we talk about affordability in housing, We're talking about housing that's actually in a price range where people can get affordable loans to buy these houses. Unfortunately, Charlottesville, over the past four decades, has went crazy with building big mansions. And unfortunately for someone, and a lot of my friends who's been working in this city for 25 or 30 years, they can't afford a $270,000 or $280,000 home. I was over on Longwood Avenue in the back, and I couldn't believe they said it's the cheapest homes in Charlottesville in the high $200,000 range. That's kind of scary. I mean, everyone likes their property values to increase. That's what you're in it for. You know, you want to have a nice nest egg, and I have no problem with that. But we also have to realize, as city leaders, and especially after what we've done to our ordinances, which makes it that you can't build a prefab house in Charlottesville. You cannot build a modular home in Charlottesville. You can't put up a tiny home in Charlottesville, all because of the ordinances. But what we do is we cut out the working class population of Charlottesville from enjoying the dream of actually being a homeowner and having somewhere affordable to live.
You know, we absolutely want families to be in affordable, safe homes. You know, when you look at what's been going on with all this development, especially on West Main Street, you see all these buildings that were really meant for students, and unfortunately none of our people can live there. And that goes to the congestion that we feel in our traffic. If we could have people living there, they wouldn't have to be driving into UVA to work at the hospital or at the university. You know, according to Habitat for Humanity, we have a deficit of 4,000 homes in this area with, of course, the urban ring of the county. And our city council smartly put down more money for the housing fund, but that's at $3.2 million. And if we divide that out, that's $400 a home. And there's no way that we are going to reach any kind of, you know, acceptable way of having enough affordable homes for our families. I keep saying that if you're going to have a special use permit, you have to build the affordable homes. And we can no longer take cash in lieu of units. I mean, it just does not make sense. You can't make this happen without putting them in the developments that are happening. And I also would encourage us to look into the Virginia Housing Development Authority. It's a statewide organization that helps people build affordable homes by lending money for that. And the county has a VHDA overlay, which is a district that is acceptable for loans in that way. And we haven't done that in the city. And I think that's something we could do pretty quickly and easily. You know, when we look at the we really need to look at it as a spectrum. Okay, we have our lowest income, which I call at this point, I'm kind of in the lingo now because I've met with so many people, 30% AMI. That's 30% of annual mean income. We have people at 70 to 80% annual mean income. We have workforce housing, and we also want to really protect our senior citizens that live in their homes and help them to stay there. And we're going to need to work, all of us together, to provide the spectrum with these different creative ways. Thank you.
Thank you. I agree with Mr. Jackson that a lot of the local ordinances need to be changed quickly. The amount of money that the city has is $3.5 million. I don't believe that the strategic development area should be developed for marketable housing. I believe every single inch of vacant land should be reserved for affordable housing. And affordable housing, in my estimate, is not $250,000 houses, but houses that range from $60,000 to $80,000 a year, so that somebody earning $30,000 can get a loan for that. And the city has to start developing an incentive program for builders to build that, then we should go ahead. Donald Trump isn't going to last forever. The Republican administration isn't going to last forever. And when we get a progressive Democratic administration back in Washington, hopefully we can go back to the days of Lyndon Johnson and Franklin Roosevelt, where the federal government will be participating in solving these housing problems. But until then, Charlottesville should do everything it can to make sure that affordable houses are built in the city.
So housing affordability, there was just an article last week about, you know, while we were having the discussions about the statue, we were kind of stepping over people, and people were being displaced from where they spent, you know, their homes, where they spent time. So we have to understand as a city that we have people who have no income, no homes, all the way up to people who can afford market rate, afford new properties like the, you know, one on Fifth Street that's starting at about $1,200, you know, for a one-bedroom apartment. So what does it look like in that range when you're talking about house affordability? So the developers being able to build like, you know, a development like Friendship Court where you're coming in potentially displacing, and the majority of the units that you propose are market rate units. So there are currently 150 families. The proposal the last time that I looked at it was at about 600 units, and they propose to keep the 150, have about 48 to 50 for our workforce, and the remainder would be market rate homes. So we have to decide as a city what we want, whether that we want a strategic investment area or we want housing that's equitable. We also need to look at, there's a developer in the 10th Street that's been purchasing in the 10th and Page neighborhood, buying homes that families purchased a long time ago. I know originally my family's home, they purchased it in the 90s for under $60,000, and now in that same area, houses are going for $249 to $270. So we need to make sure that, for me, there's a campaign that people understand the value of their homes, and that developers are not able to go in, and just because people may have purchased it 20, 25 years ago or more for a lot less, that they are, you know, that they understand the value of it today.
Thank you.
Affordable housing means, what do we mean by it? It means low-income apartments and health housing and urban development, HUD, foreclosed homes. Low-income housing in Charlottesville, Virginia, affordable housing means affordable apartments, housing authorities, and waiting lists. There are 32 low-income housing apartment complexes which contain 2,081 affordable apartments for rent in Charlottesville, Virginia. Many of these rental apartments are income-based Section 8 subsidized apartments. These are apartments you sign up for and are put on a waiting list that seems interminable in Charlottesville. There are 1,368 other low-income apartments that don't have rental assistance but are still considered to be affordable housing for low-income families. The HUD-funded public housing agency that serves Charlottesville is the Charlottesville Redevelopment and Housing Authority. I have examples here. The Grady Avenue Group Home has 4 units low-income housing. The Apatha Village, 14 units. Treesdale, 88 units. Carrollton Avenue Group Home, 4 units low-income housing. The Blue Ridge Commons, 202 units. Charlottesville Redevelopment and Housing Authority, the Section 8 and Public Housing Agency in Charlottesville. Its project-based voucher waiting list is open indefinitely. Housing Choice Voucher waiting list is closed. Piedmont Housing Alliance is a Section 8 public housing agency in Charlottesville. Thank you.
I just want to repeat the question before we start. Yes. Sharing thoughts on what affordable housing means and your ideas for providing it.
Correct.
When I think about affordable housing, I reflect on the people I continue to meet in our community. The resident in Fifeville, who for 2 years has had 6 people of her extended family living with her because they were placed out of their rental property when that owner decided to sell. The single mom in Friendship Court, who is raising her son and does not own a car, but lacks options for moving up because in order to do something she could afford would require living in the county or beyond, and that would require her to also invest in transportation. To the many retired folks in multiple neighborhoods who express concern about not being able to stay in the places that they've had and called home for decades because of rising assessments that are competing with retirement incomes that are steadier in decline. Too many in our community are cost burdened. We need to broaden our commitment and council to address this crisis. Our city needs to leverage its own resources, whether it's funding, land, or grants, and work in partnership with the Housing Authority, private sector developers, and other investors. We must be proactive in pushing housing providers to come up with fundable projects. In 2008, a bill was passed that enables the city to receive funds, which Amy was referring to earlier, from development, but I agree that we can't just be taking funds. We need to build units. We need to increase the income levels for those who qualify for the Housing Affordability Program, which has not been adjusted since its inception in 2006, and similarly for our senior and disabled tax relief programs. We need to commit to expanding options not only within the strategic investment area, but all over our city. Affordable renting must be part of the solution. We also have to do more to help those people who are working class that want to become first-time home buyers. There's another thing that's come up that I've looked into is a progressive and equitable land value tax, where we are providing incentives for people to develop for the highest use, and in this case, I'm referring to housing. Again, addressing these cannot be accomplished, however, by the city alone. The deficits in housing make it clear that the county needs to be addressing this crisis as well. And beyond housing directly, we must continue to be improving opportunities for people and access to jobs, childcare, and transportation to those who need it most.
Thank you. So our next question, we'll start with Ms. Loffer. And this is where my Bryce Springs bias comes out a little bit. Mm-hmm. Please discuss your thoughts on communication with the county, and particularly as it relates to the build-out of the Southern Growth Area and the impacts it's having on our neighborhoods.
Yeah. Well, even just generally, our communications and our relationship with the county, I think we can't forget that we are still in a lawsuit because we want to put a bike path around the reservoir, and the county did not want us to do that. And we're also constantly discussing revenue sharing agreement. I know on the school board, almost every year I've been on the school board, there's been a bill suggested by Rob Bell to end the revenue sharing agreement for the school's portion, which would be $2.5 million. And I think we're going to be facing the same issue this year, and I think it'll probably be the whole revenue sharing agreement. And, you know, we do have great partnerships with them, of course. We have our K-Tech, the transit group that Heather just talked about, and a whole host of other issues with our water and sewer. But, you know, we have to get real about regional issues. And the Southern development, I mean, all of us, well, I know I lived over by Willoughby. I come out here all the time for Jackson Bayou. You can't but see everything that's going on. You know, the 5th Street and Avon Street have just exploded with housing, and we need to work with them and really question how to maintain your neighborhood with this happening at the same time. I know I mentioned about that the county had actually applied for a VDOT grant. They didn't get it. We need to go back and try to do that again with the help of Fry Springs Neighborhood Association, Redfields. I would really encourage all of our neighborhood associations to reach out to the county. We don't have to just wait for our county and city leaders to do that. I think neighborhoods getting together like that is much more powerful. And, of course, we've seen on Sunset and Old Lynchburg Road, the average traffic has increased within, the last 15 years from 2,100 trips a day to 3,800 trips a day. So, I mean, this definitely is, and those roads were not meant for that. So partnering with them on a local level and with our city and county officials is really critical, and I hope to be part of that. Thank you.
I was a certified addiction counselor for 8 years up in Philadelphia, and one of the skills that I actively sought to acquire was the ability to defuse situations. You know, and I think sometimes with the cooperation with different governmental bodies, that skill can come in handy. And that means listening to Albemarle County's and their concerns and sometimes being willing to compromise. That whole issue about the bike paths, you know, for that park that's in Albemarle County, I would have compromised and dropped our insistence on having the bike path. The land is in Albemarle County. They have the right to regulate how they want land to be utilized. And I wouldn't have made it, if I found out that Albemarle County was being insistent, I would have dropped that issue. I think we have to be willing to compromise sometimes, see the other person's point of view. And at the same time, if it's an issue that's important for us to pursue, be aggressive in doing that. What we have to do with Alamo County, and I also think the surrounding counties, is be able to sit down and articulate what are the common issues that we need to work together with and devise ways of doing that. And I'm an amateur student of history, and one of the presidents that I didn't admire when he was in office, but I admired him in retrospect, was Lyndon Johnson. And sometimes when you negotiate with people or governmental bodies, you have to be able to spend a lot of attention doing that, and sometimes just get people in a closed door and lock the door until you get an agreement. That may be a little bit ridiculous to put it that way, but if you're going to negotiate to work together, you have to put the time and energy to do it with the negotiating partners. That's it.
Thank you.
So from that urban growth rate is about, from what I can remember, 5% of, and the rest of the county's population is rural. And I think if we look at it, you know, on the map, we understand that that's because of how close in proximity it is to the city. So that, again, goes back to city-county relations, and I've said consistently throughout the campaign that, you know, with the parks and whether their bikes can go or not, what we saw consistently, I thought, in reading and watching was that it was very ego-driven in how those decisions were decided, and it seemed like there was a lack of respect. And so that is, you know, primary in making sure that those relationships work, is making sure that there's respect on both ends and that we're open to the negotiation process and that we're open to seeing through the lenses of the other. So with that, people are living in that area in close proximity to the city because they can't live here, either because of affordability or just, you know, we don't have enough space to house. So that means that the county partnership is going to be essential in making sure that we fix the issues with housing. It's not, Charlottesville will not be able to fix those issues alone. We just do not have the land, you know, to be able to do that. And so making sure that growth works for all parties involved is going to be to the best interest of citizens in the county and the city. Thank you.
The Southern Urban Area B Study is a cooperative project among the City of Charlottesville, County of Albemarle, and University of Virginia. The study focuses on the JPA Fontaine area, including university and county properties adjacent to the city boundary and lying south of Moores Creek. When completed, the study will produce a framework plan focusing on significant demographic, socioeconomic, land use, transportation, and student housing patterns and trends. Albemarle County's neighborhood model is a guide for developing the county's designated development areas. It was appended to the comprehensive plan on May 16, 2001. Subsequent changes to the land use portion to the comprehensive plan to reinforce the neighborhood model were adopted on July 10, 2002. The neighborhood model describes the more urban form of development desired for the development areas. It establishes the 12 principles for development that should be adhered to in new development proposals. Thank you.
I had an opportunity to ride with a Fry Springs resident last spring through the Southern Growth Area, and while I'd ridden my bike in that direction and also visited friends several times, it was really that tour that really gave me a firm grasp on the extent of the build-out, both in process and what is planned, and the impact that it would significantly have on our city's neighborhoods. I share the concern of both city and county residents, especially those in the vicinity of Fifth Street Extended and Old Lynchburg Road, about accommodating the impact of this growth. The characteristics of Old Lynchburg Road and Sunset Avenue in particular are not adequate for the increased usage of cars, not to mention the safety concerns there are for bicyclists and pedestrians, and we're certainly trying to increase, you know, the volume of those modes of transportation. And that safety is not only because of volume, but because of the speed of those vehicles, and we certainly need more enforcement there. There were countless times when I realized walking our city's neighborhood that on one side of the street is someone who lives in the city, on the other side is someone who lives in the county. And I asked myself, why would that other person's priorities be any different than the person on the inside? And as a result, I think we have to look at this regionally. We need to have better and more proactive communications between the county and the city as we evaluate our current state and our future growth, especially around this urban ring, which is going to be where a lot of the development is going to have to take place because it does provide close proximity to all the amenities of the city itself. But it will take partnerships, and it must go beyond. It must include our elected officials, but it must go beyond our elected officials. I believe that we should be looking at possibly staffing, some of our staffing regionally. So we obviously have some roles that are redundant in both the city and in the county, and I think if there are opportunities for us to kind of combine those, I think there can be a lot of efficiencies that way, as well as allow us to really have a visioning for a region versus a city and a county. I believe we also need to invest in infrastructure collaboratively with focusing on interconnectivity that gives people options, whether they travel by bicycle, by bus, by bike, or by foot. We need to be both strategic and diligent in evaluating these options. But we also need to go, again, beyond words when it comes to regional transportation and affordable housing. As it was alluded to earlier, while most development is being done by right, we want to better understand what measures the county is taking. And in the case of the southern growth area, in close proximity to the urban center, we need to be having their support if we're really going to address our affordable housing crisis.
Thank you. Mr. Jackson?
That was a lot. Communication with the county has actually really took a downturn. It's been the worst I've ever seen. We have to remember that Charlottesville has always been, even when it was just a town and a hamlet, the county seat of Albemarle. And Albemarle used to stretch all the way to Amherst, Nelson, all of that used to be Albemarle County. So we've always had a sister relationship with Albemarle. I've heard people talk about Old Lynchburg Road. You grew up here and you know it. It's never had sidewalks. It's never been fixed, not even in the city area. That's something we've never really addressed for some strange reason, even though Azalea Park is over there. You should play baseball there. We have to learn as a city that Albemarle is an independent county as well, and they have to look out for their citizens. So what we need to do is we need to start sitting down and actually talking to them and not talking at them. When you think about a lawsuit, which that's money that could be spent elsewhere over a walk path and a piece of property that's not even ours. And I'm kind of concerned because I hear a lot of good talking up here, but are you going to follow your fellow people, your fellow party members, and continue the same thing? Because this has been rolling downhill for the longest time. As far as us being the infrastructure of Albemarle County, they're threatening to pull the courthouses. Albemarle Stonefield alone should tell us Albemarle really can build for themselves. The profit sharing, yes, I'd be upset too when $18 million that we keep giving the city is not accounted for by the state. And our superintendent, for some reason, gets bonuses on top of a huge salary. So, yeah, I would kind of be, we got to look at ourselves too as a city and what we can do better and how we can actually work with the county and not just work at them.
Okay, thank you. So our next question, some of y'all have alluded to already, but here's your opportunity to just really tell us, how do you feel about the city council and how it's currently operating and what you intend to do if you're elected to the council? I'll start with Mr. Long.
I think the current city council is a disgrace. I think all five current members should be replaced, should either be resigned or be called from office. Mayor Singer, when he took office a year and a half ago, took the initiative and assumed a lot of powers which was not his legally, and the city council let him get away with it. Just recently, the city council set some protocols where they took back the authority. They don't allow Mayor Singer to preside over meetings anymore. I think Mike Singer is arrogant. I think he's a tool for corporate interest. I think he's narcissistic. And he's totally unqualified to be mayor. I think when Ms. Gavin and Mr. Bellamy and Mr. Singer was elected and took office in January of 2015, both Mayor Singer and Mr. Bellamy who I happen to like had no previous leadership positions. You know, and I don't know why they were elected mayor and vice mayor. I think we need an entirely new council. And I was brought up as a Democrat. The proudest moment of my life was in 1970 in Pennsylvania. You register by party. And I was proud to register as a Democrat, and I was proud to vote for George McGovern the first time I cast a presidential vote. But one-party rule is bad, whether it was communist parties in the Soviet Union or the Democratic Party here in Charlottesville. We need opposition. There's a reason why the Republicans don't run candidates, because the current city council is serving the interest of the business class and corporate interests in this city. They don't need to run Republican candidates. All five members are lackeys of the Republican Party. We need some independence, and I hope that the people within my voice, we have four independent candidates, and I'm sure the two Democratic candidates are very nice people. I enjoy listening to them, but we need to elect two independent candidates on November 7th, and if we don't, shame on Charlottesville.
Thank you, Sam.
Could you repeat the question, please?
Yes, ma'am. The question was actually, what do you think about the way City Council is currently operating, and what will you do if you're elected?
So since the current members have been on council, we've been challenging, and I've been challenging council rules in terms of how citizens can speak, counselors' response, ability to respond. I think we're all asking and looking and seeking answers after the events of the summer. But one thing I'll point out, and if you go back through city council meetings and watch the archives, it's been pretty clear that our councils, even before this one, have been functioning at a pretty dysfunctional space. And so that is something that we've allowed as citizens to get out of control. And based on, we keep talking about campaign finance and how that works, individuals who is really running our city government is a question that I've been consistently asking. And I think that those five members, while they make a lot of decisions, that they are influenced often by people who are not sitting on the DS and not by city staff. So that is something that we as a city, we need to discuss in terms of how to make the city more responsive to the needs of citizens. That will take citizen engagement. And engagement has picked up after the summer, but we know that attention spans tend to be short. Even in times of crisis, we have a hard time holding on. And unless citizens remain engaged and are willing to put the time and effort into making sure that the government, how our government is run, changes, then it will go back to business as usual and how it has been. So we have to make sure that we demand that our city council functions at a level of efficiency that it hasn't been. And my time is up. So, yeah.
Thank you. Mr. Hall.
The city council's current operation is subpar and needs to be taken to task on a number of issues as follows. One, it was a mistake for Kristen Zekos to make a motion to shroud the Lee and Jackson statues. Two, it was a mistake to waste valuable council time voting on whether to remove the statues in the first place. Polls have since been taken of the people, majority of whom say they want the statues left alone. Three, the question of removing the statues or not is now to be decided by a judge, which is another waste of time. Four, a classified memo was leaked, critical of Charlottesville City Manager Maurice Jones' handling of communications planning, and the response to the White Nationalists Unite the Right rally on August 12th remains unconfirmed. But Jones released a five-page rebuttal to the memo. Mike Signer, Charlottesville mayor, complained that he wasn't allowed to review security plans or to be in the command center during the rally. Jones, in his written reply to the memo, said Signer threatened twice to fire him, the police chief, after they refused to let him into the command center because they were concerned about having too many people in a cramped space. It seems we have five members of a current city council that act like children at the expense of legitimate city business not being done. Thank you.
I think council is viewed right now as less of a collaborative body that is addressing the needs of our city and more a set of individuals pursuing their own agendas. Council and our city management continue to fall short on providing clear, consistent communication to this community. Everything that came from the city during and in the wake of August 12th was reactive and not proactive, with so many questions remaining. And on this and other events, I feel strongly about diverse citizen presence and participation in any review board or investigation that takes place. As a neighborhood leader, I know how many emails get sent to leadership, and they end up in the abyss. When we moved from pre and post August 12th, this lack of responsiveness and connectedness gave city leadership very little to stand on. I believe that it's imperative for those who want to serve our community to remain responsive and connected to the people that they serve. The connectedness to community members has been a hallmark of my campaign and a thing that excites me most about serving. Our city is hungry for leadership that is going to listen and to follow through. For me, working to earn the trust of this community means continuing to be out in our neighborhoods, building relationships with those I hope to represent, providing a conduit for their voices to be heard. It also means greater personal understanding for how our most vulnerable residents are feeling. Our government needs to take stock of what's wrong and leverage our entire community to take action on making our community a better place for everyone who wants to call it home. As leaders, we need to work together to foster a culture of responsiveness and accountability. As leaders, we need to be building relationships with each other based on trust and respect, and with our community based on trust and respect. We need to allow ourselves to listen and learn from each other, almost especially when our perspectives are different. I hope to bring a voice of unity to this community and focus on collaboration while on council.
Thank you, Mr. Jackson.
Well, this isn't the only city council I'm disappointed in. It's just the one that's most blatant and most loud and most stupid. The fact of the matter is, I'm not going to just name one because all of them are at fault. When you're a city council, that means all five of you sit there and you make decisions and you try and make the right decisions, but they affect every citizen in this city. And I think they seem to have forgotten that. You have some people, one of my good friends today told me, said, either you can be an advocate or be another Al Sharpton, or you can be a politician. And being a politician means that you have to be there for the people. You represent the people. In this case, we represent everybody in Charlottesville. Even just one counselor has to represent every citizen in Charlottesville. That's the unique thing about an at-large voting system. It makes things a little skewed and a little lopsided at the same time. For some reason, we don't want districts or precincts to make you more accountable to the citizens you serve. But having said that, when I hear a council person scream, F the police, when I see a city council meeting being taken over, fingers going up in the air, people getting cursed at and stuff, I'm afraid to even go to a council meeting, and I've been going to them since I'm 15 years old. I've never been so disgusted, and there's no excuse for it. Common decency and respect. I mean, we all want it, but you've got to give it in order to get it, especially when someone hasn't said anything. And when I hear a council person say, no cooperation, and then you wonder why we have problems with Albemarle County, you don't already said you're not going to cooperate. Your ears are closed and your mind is set. And I have to ask, this is just party politics. And it's been party politics for the longest time.
Thank you, Mr. Jackson.
Well, disappointing is an understatement, I think. You know, when you see a document leaked to the Daily Progress, you think, what are you talking about? Is that like a federal government? I mean, it's just, it seems outrageous, honestly. And I think we really have, I categorize it as four issues facing the City Council. And number one is the lack of trust in relationship between the City Council members themselves and the staff. I mean, if what you saw from that leaked document speaks loudly of the lack of trust and responsibility and relationship amongst the five and the staff. And I think that's the first thing that's going to have to be addressed. And then I think the next thing, going to, Kenny's point of, you know, the groups that are coming to the meeting, we need to create relationships with these people, okay? They're bringing concerns, and we need to be talking outside of the room, you know? And then I would say the overarching thing we need to do is let's start talking about the real issues and start coming up with some real solutions on affordable housing, infrastructure, workforce development, and job creation. That's what most of us want to see that body doing, and the staff working diligently to do as well. And then I think our fourth kind of issue is all of these lawsuits within the past 2 years. You know, we have gotten ourselves into a parking lawsuit, a statue lawsuit, a lawsuit about a bike path with the county, who we should be working with. I mean, this is not how you govern. So, I will just say that I've been on the school board for 6 years. It's the same type of governing body, okay? It's the vision, and, you know, we work with a superintendent. It's the city manager for the city. We set a vision. We ask that city manager to implement it, and we work together and have serious discussions, and, you know, it can be better, and it should be better, and I think we should all demand more. Thank you.
Okay, thank you very much. So we have one question left, preset question, and then we'll try to go to four questions. See a few more. So this one is intentionally a little vague. So Ms. Walker, we'll start with you. Please address the city's historical legacy and what you and your vision for how to move forward.
So is that... And I, when you all sent that out, is that in regards to the summer, the events of the, just overall? Okay. So in terms of where we are today after the events of the summer, and how the tone of the city had been set long before the summer, we have to, you know, honor people. We have to listen to people, and we have to create a government and a city that's, our government has to create a city that's equitable. I've lived here my entire life. I have not lived in a city that's equitable. I've lived in a city that is the tale of two cities, the beautiful, ugly, that is this dual path depending on who you are, where you come from, what your income level is. I haven't lived in a city where all people have the ability to thrive, and I think that has set the foundation for the events that we experience in Charlottesville over the summer. We see major disparities in every area. Wealth, health, housing, jobs, and for us to, we have to take that seriously, and we have to be committed that everyone who lives here, has lived here, has the ability to grow and thrive. And we haven't had leaderships that have, or really our, as citizens in Charlottesville, we haven't been willing to have the hard conversations that will force us into change. And it shouldn't require the event starting in May of this year for us to start processing those questions. And some people are still pondering, some people are still contemplating, and we have to move into action if we want a city where all people can thrive.
Thank you. Mr. Hall?
Okay.
Can you repeat the question?
Yeah.
So, please address the city's historical legacy and your vision for moving forward.
Okay. I took this question related to the legacy of the Civil War, especially since we're talking about statues a lot. Civil War being Civil War, statues. The statues now shrouded reflect a legacy rooted in the Civil War. On Saturday, August 12, 2017, a day that will live in Charlottesville infamy, hundreds of protesters came to our parks and streets, bringing to the fore the legacy of the American Civil War and turning our otherwise typical university town into a deadly flashpoint between white nationalists and counter-protesters. Lost in the violence was the core debate over removing public monuments, symbols of the Confederacy, as our current leaders plan to do by ordering the dismantling of a statue of Confederate General Robert E. Lee. Here are some fast facts about the city during the Civil War era. One, Charlottesville, with a population of about 3,000 people, remained on the fringes. Perhaps the only noteworthy conflict was a skirmish on the north of town on February 29, 1864, the Battle of Rio Hill. Two, the Union forces at Rio Hill were led by Brigadier General George Armstrong Custer. He bungled badly, perhaps foreshadowing 10 years later at the Little Bighorn. At Rio Hill, Custer and his 1,500 Union soldiers attempted to raid a Confederate camp, but fled with their troops, chased out by Confederates led by Major General Jeb Stuart. UVA, like Charlottesville, escaped the war's ravages. The student body, 500 of 600 enrollees, in 1861 joined the Confederate Army, as did more than 2,000 alumni. UVA enrollment plummeted to 46 students in 1862 to 1863. Only 8 graduated. UVA never closed.
Thank you.
Thank you.
There's no doubt in my mind that racial segregation and economic inequality are linked. I recognize I am a white person of privilege, and for me to address the city's historical legacy means talking about it with a diverse representation from our community. And based on those conversations, I've come to view it through juxtapositions. Consider Thomas Jefferson, a founding father who recognized the importance of owning land and being self-sufficient, who was also a slave owner who explicitly said that he felt black people were inferior. Consider UVA, a world-class public university that didn't admit minorities or women until the 50s and 60s, and it's a chasm between those affording the opportunity to attend the university and those working class to support it. Consider our school system, where we're segregated and a decision was made purposely to close them rather than afford equal opportunity. And consider our urban center, a thriving downtown public space, yet it came at a price that was far too steep with the rising of Vinegar Hill and redevelopment of other African-American neighborhoods, which are still impacting people today. Each historical point leads itself to a current and future point. I believe government is a means of solving the problem of economic inequality, and I'm committed to working with our city's leadership, its citizens, the county, and the university, as it's going to take a collaborative effort by creating housing, which is envisioned through the lens that learns from things that we've done poorly in the past, by providing educational opportunities and emphasizing importance in changing the generational course, by enhancing workforce opportunities for unemployed and working class, and refocusing infrastructure, creating better accessibility so that neighborhoods aren't cut off from amenities or from each other. And last, supporting opportunities for cultural integration and appreciation through community events. And while efforts have had some success, we need to better understand the barriers that are getting in the way from making them self-sustaining. My life has been enriched the past 9 months by going into spaces where I myself have not felt comfortable. I will continue to explore these spaces, and I'll also invite and be welcoming to others who may not be comfortable in the spaces that I share. The history of Charlottesville has been intentional, and its past is checkered with good and bad. But I believe our future is hopeful, and we are all able to come together. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Jackson.
That's a lot. I don't even know where to really begin. Because the historical legacy of Charlottesville goes back from the conception of this country all the way to really present day. It's not just founded on the 12th. It's not just founded on the statues or slavery. I'm sorry, because it really ticks me off as a black man whose grandfather, great-grandfather was a slave, how we just keep beating that down. We
We blacks have done so much more than civil rights and slavery. You know, we talk about Thomas Jefferson. We don't talk about his nephew, Peter Jefferson, who 60 miles away set aside land for freed blacks for Israel Hill. You want to talk about doctors and lawyers? And if we want to get technical about Vinegar Hill, for those people who remember, Vinegar Hill wasn't no paradise. I should know. My family came out of there. Half of it was slums. Those who owned the property sold it and moved. This pity party is getting ridiculous. You know what makes Charlottesville great? Is the fact that a little black boy grew up on Brown Street where he used to throw pears to the inmates in the city yard jail. He went off and got an education, even though people in the projects busted windows out his house. He didn't sit back and feel sorry for himself. He had people there to push him, white and black, to make sure he got educated. And then I could instill that into my child. But a pity party? If that's what we think Charlottesville history is about, that we've put people down so bad? You have not because you don't want it. Your past does not have to be your future. And what are we going to do? Just keep giving our kids crutches? You're poor, you're black, you'll never amount to anything.
So, actually, I have to look. My daughter is trying to get a ride from my husband. I just want to make sure that's not her trying to get a hold of me. Nope, we're good.
That's fine.
Sorry. She has a volleyball game tonight. But that's hard to follow that. So I moved here 16 years ago. I grew up on a dairy farm in Wisconsin, a small town of 600 people. I have 7 brothers and sisters. I shared a bed with my sister until my oldest sister moved out. And she went to college, actually, and that was the first person in our family to go to college. And I can't tell you how proud we all were. And it was amazing to go and visit her. And I followed in her footsteps, thank goodness, got my degree, went into the Peace Corps, met this guy that's actually from Charlottesville, and ended up moving here 16 years ago. And I got a job out in Louisa County, a middle school math and science teacher. And one of the first things that happened to me was two of my coworkers, while we're sitting around the cafeteria, telling me that they do Civil War reenactments. And I tell you, I was like, what are you talking about? I had no idea that this was a thing. You know, they told me very passionately about their characters that they played, you know, every, I don't remember how many times a year. And then within that same year, one of the teachers photocopied articles about the desegregation of Louisa County Public Middle School, and I could not believe reading that article that many of my students' parents had lived through this and had seen, and their grandparents, and you know, so the historical legacy. I am still new; it's 16 years here, but what I'm saying is that we all need to work hard together on a brighter future for all of us, and I think that includes workforce development, something I could talk about is the Piedmont Promise. Let's support our CHS graduates that can want to go to PVCC and qualify. Let's work on affordable housing. You know, you should be able to live and work in this town. And also, let's work on our infrastructure. We know a lot of barriers are because of the busing system is not good, or we can't bike or ride or walk to work or school. So let's work on the issues that we can come together and find a resolution on. Thank you.
I'm not going to address what Charlottesville's historic legacy is. I think we should be discussing what America's historic legacy is. And the reason I'm saying it, I was raised in the North, but I was very fortunate. My father was born and raised in the Bronx, New York. My mother was from the Deep South, born and raised in a farm near Lafayette, Louisiana. They met during World War II and settled in Philly. I remember, since I'm the oldest candidate running for office, I beat Mr. Hall by a couple years. I remember as a young child when the Little Rock High School was integrated, and I was only 7, 8 years old, and the Prince Edward County, the Virginia schools closing down, and my mother saying, this is terrible, there should be a better way to address these problems. I didn't know what she was talking about until I got older, and my mother hated to see the South disrespected and shown in a bad light. I'm saying it's a lead up to this, as in Philadelphia, when the Constitutional Convention was held to draft a constitution, Northerners agreed to a compromise where African Americans were considered three-fifths of a person for the purposes of the census. And it meant the Northern liberals actually capitulated to the South and refusing to abolish slavery then. This is just as much a Northern problem as it was a Southern problem. And I remember in Boston in 1974 when they had school busing and the white people were chasing Senator Edward Kennedy down the street and throwing bricks at him. And I remember when Dr. King went to Chicago in 1968, he said he never saw as much hatred as he did when he went to Chicago. The whole problem of freedom and working together is an American problem that we have to address as a country. I don't believe in castigating Charlottesville. The entire country and we all as Americans have to confront our history, and a lot of it is not nice. And I appreciate Mr. Jackson's remark that, you know, that we have to consider looking at each other as human beings and strive to be better and strive to make sure that equity, that everybody is treated on an equitable basis throughout the country.
Thank you. So now, those are our six questions, and we really, really appreciate your thoughtful responses. We have some questions here from the audience. There's a few more that are about to be handed to me. We've got about half an hour. I want to leave 6 minutes so each of you have a minute for a closing statement. So I'll try and get through three or four of these. My thought is to actually I'll read off the questions and maybe give each you 30 seconds, I'll give each 1 minute to respond. If we can get through three or four of them. Thank you. We've already talked about the level of discourse at the City Council. I don't want to rehash that. But I would like to... We've already talked about City Council and how you all feel about that, so I don't want to rehash that. But I would like to give you another opportunity to sort of specifically address what you would do to address the situation and help us move forward. Mr. Hall?
I would suggest we move forward by I have some suggestions. These are general suggestions on moving forward. Marry the right person. Be in love. This is one decision that will determine 90% of your happiness or misery. To become the most positive and enthusiastic person you know. 3, always remember persistence. Persistence, persistence, persistence. 4, be perceptive. Remember, judge fairly. Thank you.
Ms. Hope?
So, I really, as I alluded to earlier, I just think it really is about relationship building. And as I've mentioned many times, like, I really made a commitment to getting to know so many people of diverse backgrounds in our community throughout, you know, the 4 months leading up to the primary and then in the time since. And it's when I realized that those voices aren't always being heard. And I don't see myself as a person who's going to be an expert in all of these areas. But what I found is there's so many people that want to be more involved in the process but haven't found a place for that voice to be heard. And I really see myself, and along with other counselors, we have to be the conduit for all of your voices to be heard. So you can bring your strengths to the table, and we can all help our city move together and forward. But it does start with listening and collaborating and that relationship building. So that's certainly been a pillar of my campaign and is something, an approach I would like to take if elected to City Council.
I'm going to be real. A friend of mine and I was talking, and that was what we discussed. Be real. I believe in this city. I want people to believe in themselves and believe in this city as well. Evolve. Always be willing to evolve. Evolution takes time. It takes patience. Respect. I will respect you. Respect others. We need to respect each other. Effort. It's not an easy job. It takes footwork. It takes stress. Attitude. I'll have a positive attitude whether you have it or not, because I believe and I have hope.
listen. Don't always be so quick to talk, but listen to each other. And work on you, because that's what I have to do.
Thank you.
So, because I have, like, is it specifically with City Council?
Yes, please.
Okay. Well, I've thought about this a lot. I've known these people a long time, you know, and I think we really need to start out as having a relationship of based on humanity and friendship, you know. So I've been on the school board about 6 years, and I've seen one other mayor, you know, and talking with each of them throughout the years, I don't think they see each other as family. Like, I would be like, hey, how is so-and-so doing? And they wouldn't even know. Like, if you were to ask me about a school board member, there's seven of us, I would probably know exactly what's kind of going on with them, because you have to be friends first, I think, and have a relationship based on not just the professional. Of course, there's the professional relationship, but you also have to understand, oh, darn it. So specifically, though, I would definitely work on some real, if I'm talking professionally, protocols that the city council should follow. We have the same thing on the school board. You know, you have the spokesperson, and then you have the members. I would talk at length if anybody's interested in doing that. But first and foremost, develop friendships and relationships with each other.
Thank you.
I think city council should be meeting once a week. I think the time allotted for people to speak and address the council should be changed from 3 minutes to maybe 7 minutes. And city council should be prepared if we have to stay there to 3 or 4 o'clock in the morning listening to everybody who wants to talk. I believe that a city council should have a great sense of humor about himself. And there's a story about Winston Churchill. Lady Astor, who was born and raised here in Central Virginia before she migrated to Great Britain, went up to Winston Churchill and she said to Mr. Churchill, Mr. Prime Minister, if I was your wife, I'd poison you. And he said, Madam, if I was your husband, I'd clearly swallow it. So I think I always need to be able to laugh at myself. And definitely, as Mr. Jackson said, to give people respect and deference. And that's extremely important, and we have to be willing to do that. Thanks a lot.
So moving forward will require that we are open to learning from the challenges, not ignoring them, and not sugarcoating. And if we want to have a town that hasn't been equitable, we can continue as we have been. But if we want a town that is equitable, where people do not have to be concerned about whether if their kids decide to join a protest, they will potentially run over by cars. If your kid goes to a council meeting, that maybe they don't see government working as efficiently as possible. That is going to require that we increase our knowledge about why things are, and not a history that has been, sugar-coated. So I hear, when I'm in the rooms a lot, I see that people want to be comfortable before doing the hard work to reach that level of comfortability. And that's one thing that we have to decide, business as usual or really hard work to move forward.
Thank you. So we have a question about what role should the neighborhood associations play in determining development that's permitted in our neighborhoods? Yes, Michelle.
So what role should neighborhood associations have play a role? This is very important to me. As a neighborhood leader, I've been part of a group of neighborhoods we all signed on, and really development was a major piece that we actually have brought to council meetings twice during our last neighborhood development leadership and now. And I think that we need to be more involved earlier and throughout the process. And I think we need to trust the leadership of our neighborhood associations to be involved in a meaningful way that can be productive. And so we have aligned, I think 14 neighborhoods signed on asking that we be part of that process. Some of the things that have already happened include that developers are now required to have a community meeting when developments are ready to take place so that we can have some proactive involvement getting into it before we see that the plans have gone through. But I feel like it is an important step. If there's no way that I feel like staff and our city's leadership can really understand the values that we are placing on some of these decisions as neighborhoods and understand the issues that we're facing unless we have a seat at the table. And so I think it's certainly a critical point, and it's something that I've worked with other neighborhood association leaders for the last 2 years to fight for.
Thank you.
Having been on two neighborhood associations, both the Fifield Neighborhood Association and the Ridge Street Neighborhood Association in my lifetime, one thing I've found is associations, they're called neighborhood associations for a reason. There's enough membership that you can touch every street and every corner of a neighborhood. Unfortunately, the one thing I did find also is the city is not willing to utilize them when it comes to planning, whether it be transit planning or economic growth, whatever. They don't use them the way they should. We have to use our neighborhood associations to get the message to the citizens before we start voting on things and have things actually almost done and prepared, and then all of a sudden have a citizens forum, and then everyone's looking like, what are you talking about? But we definitely need to keep the neighborhood associations together, strengthen them, and work with them.
Thank you.
Yeah, I would echo all of that. They should be involved as early as possible when looking at these things. Actually, I was just at the Locust Grove community meeting about the Macus property, and one of the residents said, hey, why don't you guys have a coffee shop at that senior living center? Maybe the neighbors could actually come over for coffee. And it was like a light bulb went off. Yes, that's actually a great idea. I think we can find a lot of good ideas from the people that actually live there. You can make better improvements to what's going on. And I think we should be, as I said, I would be willing even to have a quarterly meeting with our neighborhood association presidents so that they can be more informed of what's going on with the city. You know, not just traffic, but all aspects. So definitely early, often, is what I believe. Thank you.
I feel that the neighborhood associations should have a very active role in the development that occurs in their neighborhood. And I can't believe that they're building a hotel across the street from Tosca Park when the majority of the neighborhood was strongly against that. In fact, I think they should have a veto power on any new development, whether it's residential or commercial. I think that's the reason that we're seeing so much unplanned development occurring throughout the city. And, you know, so that's how I feel, that they should have a veto power and should definitely be brought in at the beginning of any proposed development in their neighborhoods.
So neighborhood associations and tenant associations are very important. Part of the work that was done with Friendship Court over the past couple of years was making sure that they had a strong tenant association in place to kind of challenge PHA and their development goals within the strategic investment area, and making sure that the families who live there, voices were heard, you know, throughout that process. We saw with the hotel on Cherry Avenue and then the Booker Street project that strong neighborhood participation from the association, but city council still decided against, you know, what one neighborhood association wanted in favor of another. So a council that honors the wishes of the neighborhood, and also increasing diversity within the neighborhood associations. I think that that's something that the members of the association, from what I've seen, can work towards also. Thanks.
Mr. Hall.
Okay. I agree with Heather about the community meeting with developers before the development starts, centered with the neighborhood association. I would also suggest that the neighborhood association have an active meeting or association with the city council to touch base on a regular basis. This is what the city council should be about. Thank you.
Thanks. This one hopefully will just be a really quick, so we can, there's a couple of really interesting questions here. But several people have asked, and so it must be on a lot of people's minds, what do you think about the smart meters downtown? The smart meters? So we'll start with Mr. Jackson.
It's the worst thing that downtown or city council ever did. We want to get technical and we want to talk about parking. We have two city parking lots that can be made into a garage at any time, working with the downtown, you know, retailers and stuff to alleviate costs to the taxpayers. The parking meters, to me, and to say that they are just there temporarily, they are trial, that's the biggest bunch of crock. And not to mention, it also hurts the low-income and regular working person. It really does. It should have never been done. We'll get on there. We'll figure out a way to remove them as quick as possible.
Thank you.
Sure. I mean, yeah, I thought it was a bad idea. I think the real question about the – I think we have many different parking issues. We have people that are employees. We have people that just want to shop there. And we have residents. So they all have different parking needs. But the real, you know, crux of all of this was that the employees needed parking, right? They like the two-hour shuffle. I mean, I know lots of people that have been doing that. And so the parking meters haven't solved that. So I agree. I mean, if we find they have been somehow, you know, successful, of course I would, you know. But I really can't imagine that they are. And actually, Seville Tomorrow just had a little story about it, how one person couldn't figure out how to use them, so they had to move. One person didn't know their license plate number, that they have to punch it in, so they moved. I mean, so actually what they're noticing is there's a lot of open spaces on the downtown now, and nobody's even using them because they can't figure it out. And I would just also add, so now what we've done is we've allowed Market Street parking to have one free hour. And so I go downtown pretty often talking to the parking attendants. Guess what? People aren't staying there for 2 hours anymore. So if we were having someone coming for lunch and maybe buying something, that's maybe not happening now. So I think there's unintended consequences. Sorry.
Thank you.
As far as parking meters is a bad idea from the beginning, they should be removed as soon as possible. You know, and I just agree with what Mr. Jackson and other people have been saying about it.
So I would not have supported the parking meters. My one chance to see how they work, parking near the police department last week, it was broken. And I wouldn't have supported it.
Thank you. Mr. Hall.
Well, I agree that the smart meters are against good planning. I don't think it's a good idea. I think the charge per hour is too high. I think it's bad for business. They've mainly been put near the downtown mall, and I think some consideration should have been given to talk to the owners of the businesses along there, see what they thought before going forward. Thank you.
I'll echo some of the things in terms of it. They seem to be much more complex, those that are in place, than I think any of us ever envisioned. It shouldn't take that much figuring out to get there, and I've heard that from multiple folks. And there's different types of meters. There's not even consistency within the relatively limited spaces that there are meters. But they are in place, and at this point, I guess the engineer in me wants to see the data, and so that we can push back that if it really isn't servicing the needs that it was intended to, that we do need to get rid of them. But we also have to be open-minded to realize that if it is showing something, there is a responsiveness from the businesses that is, you know, and somewhat positive, we have to kind of be prepared to deal with that. But I did hear from businesses, there was a difference of opinion in terms among the area businesses in terms of whether they viewed them as positive or negative because of the two-hour shuffle, which oftentimes employees were using those in the most immediate spots. And when I talk to people who just want to go to the mall for, you know, just an hour or want to go in quickly, that they don't have a lot of options and they end up schlepping, you know, several blocks because those spots are always occupied because of that shuffle. And so I certainly want to be open-minded about what this data will share with us. But I do feel like right now it's not even really good data because they seem to be pretty inefficient in terms of how they're being implemented right now.
All right, thank you. So we've got time for one more question, and I apologize. There's a lot of good questions up here. I would like to each of you to address the question is, look at the age of the people in the room, and how would you encourage young adults, or just more people in general, to become civically engaged? I'm going to start with Ms. Hoffman.
It's me.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Well, you know, having three children myself, 13, 11, and 9, I know it's a challenge to do anything after, you know, in the evening and working at, you know, but I really actually think civic engagement, where you're at, whatever organization you're already involved, you know, like if you go to church or you go to synagogue and you feel passionate, get involved there, okay? And then broaden your perspective. You know, if the neighborhood association is where you feel most passionate about, get more involved there. You know, I just think it takes, honestly, a village to do all these things. I know for myself, after being on the school board, I got really passionate about, like, women being in office, and I started a women's group called Virginia's List that supports Democratic women running for state office because I realized there's not a lot of women there when I go to Richmond. So whatever your passion is, delve into that deeper and just commit more time and energy into that. So thank you.
I came of age during the 1960s, and I graduated from high school in 1967. And I think it's safe to say that people of my generation were actively engaged in the political process. Whether it was 18, 19-year-old young people going down in freedom buses to desegregate the South, involvement with the Vietnam War, both pro and con, and other issues. I remember when I was 10 years old, my father watching the Democratic Convention, and it was one of the few times that he allowed me to sit down and watch TV with him. And I was fascinated with the people marching up and down the aisles with signs and using McCarthy's nomination of Adlai Stevenson. I've been in love with political politics ever since. And I get discouraged when I talk to young people in their 20s that say they've never voted. And I don't know how to turn that around, but I think in a free society, Edmund Burke says we all are stakeholders and we all need to participate. And I simply don't know how to encourage the younger generation to do that.
Walker.
So my campaign is doing great with the younger generation. They are. I'm getting a lot of support, lots of students, lots of locals contacting, engaging, having conversations. My son, who's a ninth grader at CHS, having lots of conversation with his friends, and he's in the back of the room that he comes home and he talks to me about. So people, the young people are paying attention, and they just want to know that you hear them, that you listen to them, and that you're not BSing them. And so that is one way, you know, to engage. But we also have to increase, I think, one thing that I would want to do on council, social media engagement. So Facebook, which I am having a hard time with, but I'm doing it. Facebook, Twitter, Instagram. My son tells me I need Instagram. I haven't gotten it yet. So we have to make sure that even if people don't show up in the rooms, that there's a way for them to communicate with us and there's a way to keep them engaged. Thanks.
Mr. Hall. This is the purview of the candidate and elected councilman to promote in the people they talk to that are young. Make campaigning interesting and engaging for all voters. Thank you.
Thank you.
So,
I think for a lot of us, I mean, all of us up here, we each of us are leading by example for our young people. I mean, my daughter, my oldest, is 7, and she has a friend who just, every time she sees me, she's like, if you win, will you get us an aquarium? Like, so I think it's important to, you know, just, we're putting ourselves out there, but you also, I agree, like it really is about listening to their ideas, because then they'll want to be engaged, but also just showing them that when you work hard, the results can happen. And I think that can start at really small levels, especially depending on the age of the children, and then obviously getting into young adults, and my brain is around my young kids because my oldest is 7. But I think I agree that we have to explore ways that whether, you know, it's at different age levels or different cultures or need states, that we find ways to communicate with them and to involve them in a process in a way that makes them comfortable and in an environment where they feel like they can participate in that process.
Mr. Jackson.
For me, I have a good rapport with young people. Children, your kids would probably just think that I'm crazy as anything, because that's just the way I am. I know how to deal with children. But when it comes to the younger generation, as far as teens and adolescents, the one thing they want you to do is what older people were for me. Be real with them.
Talk to them. When you engage them in conversation, and don't be a hypocrite. That's the one thing young people will tell you real quick, no matter if it's church or anything else. Don't be nice to me at a meeting and then see me on the street and you don't know me. Young people will turn you off if you're a hypocrite. But we have to engage them. We have to talk to them. We have to explain to them and just let them know why government affects every aspect of our lives and their lives.
Thank you. I regret that we can't get to the rest of the questions, so I want to give each of the candidates 1 minute for a closing statement, and we'll start with Ms. Walker and work way back.
Well, thanks for having me. I think what I'll leave you with today is that, you know, the concept of exceptionalism and how, you know, if one or two have done it, many can. And unless we create the environment for that to happen, it doesn't happen. So in my own life, I have raised and am raising 3 children. I've had 1 graduate from Hampton University. I've graduated from Virginia Commonwealth. My son went into high school with almost 4 years of high school credits. And I have a daughter who is beyond brilliant that can do with whatever that she puts her mind to doing. Arts, traditional education, making clothing, you know, et cetera. And I could have, in my world, pretended that the issues that we are facing do not exist because they don't knock at my house door often, right? And I know how to advocate for myself and fight. And so when you work within a community setting, understanding interdependence, that you work for collective, a whole, no matter what's going on. Thank you.
I want to thank the neighborhood associations for inviting me to attend this forum and for people for listening to me. I'm not going to appeal to anybody for their vote. I think people have made up their mind, and a lot of people have told me, you, Paul Long, I'm going to vote for you, and a lot of people have said some other things that I'm not going to repeat at a public table. And I think a lot of people know where I stand on different issues. I just want to make a statement about November of 2008, when I was at the Venerable School to vote for the next president of the United States, and I had to wait almost 3 hours as the line was making its way to vote. Most times, the 20 years I've been here, at city council elections, no more than 25% of the registered voters vote for city council. I will love when November 7th comes around that I have to wait 3 hours to cast a vote. Anybody within my hearing or my voice, you know, this city council has more effect on your life than the president of the United States. That may not quite be true, but I want to see 80 to 90% of the people showing up and voting for city council in November. Thank you.
Thank you.
Ms. Hacker. So I want to say thank you to everyone for staying here so long and for Brian and Heather for organizing this. I know it takes a lot of work, and Seville tomorrow again for giving us the PA system. And I want a little break time too. My neighborhood has about 10 kids, and 4 of the girls are now playing running for city council. They're all standing there giving speeches, making yard signs and postcards. And, you know, it really is, we are role models. I take that seriously. And it's been really a pleasure, actually, you know, going door to door, talking, working on school board. I've enjoyed all of it. And I've really, you know, enjoyed tonight discussing all these issues. I would love to be on city council to work on these issues. And I've really enjoyed the past 2 forums being able to hear Mr. Long, Ms. Walker, Mr. Jackson, and Mr. Hall, and all of their ideas. I think collectively together we can come up with really great solutions to real issues of affordable housing, workforce development, job creation, and infrastructure. And I am asking for your vote on November 7th, so thank you. And Heather Hill, I'm sorry. I took
thank
too
you.
Much time with that kid story, sorry.
Mr. Jackson.
Well, thank you for having me. Especially since I live right over there, it wasn't hard to walk here. But really, this is going to be a very important election. City council may just seem like, oh, it's something we don't want to go to the polls for, but it has to be. And if I don't appeal with you because I don't sit there and use color or anything as a
card. I'm sorry about that. That's just not me. I believe in people. I believe that once we start loving each other and caring about each other and doing for one another and helping each other, there is nothing that we can't overcome. And as a city leader, that's what I want to be there for. Thank you.
Thank you again to the neighborhood associations for providing this opportunity. It's been my work engaged and with passionate citizens and other neighborhood leaders that really inspired me first to run. I also want to thank my fellow candidates for sharing your perspectives, and most importantly, thank all of you, you know, for being here and involved in this process. And considering your vote in November, we've learned something from all the voices this evening, and I'm committed to continuing to learn. It's certainly been a pillar of my campaign. I would echo the question on that Mr. Long raised earlier about our historical legacy needs addressing more at the national level, but if we're really asking ourselves to be the capital of resistance, it needs to be done by resisting the trajectory of increasing inequality that has always existed in our city, in our state, in our country, and in our world. If we do that here in Charlottesville, I believe that we can be a thriving, desirable place to live, work, and learn for everyone, and it's not going to take an expensive PR campaign to be a budget item. I also believe City Council's success, as I said, is being a conduit for the passion, ideas, and informed perspectives throughout our community. That's your passion, your ideas, and your strengths. And I certainly invite you to join me. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Hall. As I have said, Charlottesville has now gone through some tumultuous times. We are still healing. We are still mending our broken hearts. Let us continue to make suggestions to one another for future successful living, such as treat everyone you meet like you want to be treated. Understand that happiness is not based on possessions, power, or prestige, but on relationships with people you love and respect. Understand that happiness is not based on possessions, power, or prestige. Help move the city forward. Give me your suggestions as I leave now. I have given you mine. Give me yours. Be a self-starter. Stop blaming others. Take responsibility for every area of your life. Take an interest in people. Be assured that I will do my best to serve you as best I can. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much.
Can we give each other a